Welcome into another edition of the Dana Victory Podcast, only on MusketeerReport.com. I'm Rick, he's Dan, and Dan, this is the 32nd edition of the Dana Victory Podcast.
Yeah, and this one's got to be, this has got to commemorate one of my favorite players to ever play at Xavier, and I know one of yours too.
Absolutely. This is my guy, Flight.
You know, when Darnell came in with, we're talking about Darnell Williams, obviously. When he came in with Lenny Brown and Gary Lumpkin, it was the same period of time as Xavier was joining the A-10. In fact, I think their freshman year was Xavier's first year in the A-10. And that, I don't think it can be emphasized how important those three guys were, and then James Posey coming in, I think, the next year, how important those guys were for the Xavier program, because they became a legit contender in the Atlantic 10 almost from day one. I think they went 500 the first year, but really put a scare in some of the top teams, including number one UMass in that famous game at the Gardens. And then the next year they won the league. So, I mean, that was such a huge thing for Xavier, because there was a lot of questions similar to this offseason. Can the program make that step up to the next level of competition from the Midwestern Collegiate Conference to the Atlantic 10, now from the Atlantic 10 to the Big East? And you hope that guys like Samaje Christen, Brandon Randolph, Miles Davis, Jalen Reynolds, Matt Stainbrook, et cetera, will be that next generation to help X make that next jump.
That's right. Well, we've got a big show planned for tonight. We do have another guest on, and this one's going to be, I think, a very fun guest. Also, we'll get a chance to catch up on his ongoing battle with cancer, and that's Joe Hughes, of course, the former walk-on. We're going to talk to him later on, and we'll also briefly, before we get there, hit on some recruiting. We'll hit on some Alexander Vezenkov news, playing in the FIBA championships, and a little bit of the current team's workouts. And I guess that's where we'll start talking about this current team. We can also hit on, I know, Dan, you went out to the Summer League out at Woodward a few weeks ago, so we can kind of talk about that as well. But
live action, Rick. Live action.
Live action. We going uptown. one thing I did kind of want to start with is something that you may have noticed if you've seen, I guess these teams have actually played each other twice now, with City Tax and Clover Nook going at it, and that's Miles Davis and D. Davis's teams, respectively. And one of the things I've noticed, but I saw both of those games, is how, let's say, just hard Miles and D were going at each other throughout those games. And it's funny because there's no animosity between them. You saw them picking each other up after the play was over, patting each other on the rear end, the typical teammate stuff. But while the game was going on, those guys were at each other's throats. They were competing. And from what I've gathered, from the little bit I've seen, and the contact or the sources that I've talked to within the program, the workouts have been the exact same way. I mean, in open gym, in workouts, the competition at the guard position is just at a completely different level than it was a year ago. And I think this is, you know, probably the most impressive guy so far through workouts, if you're talking about players who have kind of looked improved, would be D. Davis. He's been outstanding. The coaches are really happy with what he's done. And I tend to think that with the competition being raised, I mean, last year, yeah, he had Samaje there, but most of the time they're running stuff together on the court. They're working on playing together because they're both going to be in the lineup. Whereas this year, there's other guys that are good enough to compete and push D every day, whether he's on Samaje's team or not. There's Brandon Randolph who wants his minutes. There's Miles Davis who wants his minutes. You know, these guys are pushing him each day, and I think that's raising his level. But overall, I think it's just going to be a good thing for the team in general at practice this year.
Well, not only that, but this is the first time in quite a while that Xavier's had a lot of guard depth. I mean, they've got four guys. Brandon Randolph's a guy that you didn't mention yet, who the day I went out to Woodward wasn't that impressive. Of course, he probably was jet lagged. I think he had flown in from California the day before, and he hurt his finger about 4 seconds into the game. But he showed some nice passing touch. He showed the ability to really be aggressive in transition. But last year, you sort of had, as you said, Samaje and D, and then Brad Redford was the third guard. And, you know, Brad did a great job of improving the other facets of his game, but really was a guy that was in there for one specific purpose, and that was to bomb away threes. I mean, no one would ever say – Brad did a – as I said, Brad developed his skills. He was a better defender, better ball handler his senior year than he was at the beginning of his career, but he still really was a guy that had one tool. And now you've got an array of guards. All of, I mean, Samaje obviously is an NBA talent, but Miles Davis has really opened people's eyes with the shape he's come in, and the shooting and scoring exhibitions he's put on in open gyms and then at the Devereaux Summer League. And Brandon Randolph's going to be right there fighting for minutes. And the forgotten man all offseason, Rick, as you talk about, is D. Davis, who was one of the key guys for this team last year. So, I mean, there's a wealth of options for Chris Mack in the backcourt this year, which is something, a luxury that he hasn't had really since his first year when the team had Mark Lyons, Tu Holloway, Jordan Crawford, Brad Redford, and Dante Jackson that could play out there. So it's a new thing for Chris to have this, to have these kind of weapons, and it's got to be something that the staff has got to be really looking forward to.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about that. I think it's kind of opening their eyes already, you know, when you see these open gyms and you see kind of how hard some of these guys are going. And you see a D. Davis rising to the top because he's being pushed. I think that definitely excites them. And one of the things about D, you know, I'm not one who buys into the whole intangibles talk all the time and the constant, he's a winner. And not just about D, I'm just talking about in general. I'm not a big fan of throwing terms like that around. What does that actually mean? But you constantly hear good things about D. Davis when it comes to the intangibles, when it comes to he's a winner, quote-unquote, you know, things like that. And what I've seen most of all is he's a tough kid, mentally and physically. And I think that, you know, what he's doing right now is showing these young guys that he's not giving up those minutes to anyone without a fight. And they're going to have to be really good to earn them. Now, you know, we've already seen some of that from Miles Davis, that he might have the ability to do so, and also Brandon Randolph. But if they do, it'll be because they earned it and not because D. Davis can't cut it.
Well, and one thing that came up in the live chat that you did on the site on Wednesday was somebody asked, what are the sorts of things that scouts, coaches, et cetera, see guys do on the court that a fan may not notice? And having the opportunity last year to sit with you, talk about the game as it was unfolding with you, listen to Coach Mack's post game comments and sit down on press row. The one thing that I noticed that I think you lose when you're a fan and you're up there sort of living the game possession by possession is watching what the guys are doing off the ball. And D. Davis is a guy that's very active off the ball, especially on defense. And I think that that's one of those things that the coaches love about a kid, because he's always plugged in. Like a guy like Jeff Robinson last year, you know, guy with all the talent in the world, but a guy who's concentration would roam at times. And sometimes you'd see Jeff Robinson make a great instinctive play to rotate back when the ball went to the other side, and you could say, okay, Jeff Robinson's plugged in today. He's going to be active on offense. He's going to be aggressive. Other times you'd see him sort of watching the paint dry, as they say in Hoosiers, and it lead to a layup behind him, and you'd be like, well, he's checked out today. This is not good. D. Davis is a guy that's very active. And I think that's – and he's also the best on the ball defender on the team. And so those two things, I think, are things that really act as a security blanket for coaches, because they know what they can expect with the guy out there.
Yeah, and he doesn't make many bad decisions with the ball in his hands either. And again, I think that toughness that he brings, you know, he's not going to melt in a big situation. You know, he can handle pressure. You know, he can think the game through. I think that gives the coaches a lot of trust in him, to be quite honest. But, you know, we could talk about D. Davis a lot. We've hit on plenty there. Let's keep it moving, because I do want to get to that Joe Hughes interview coming up here in a little bit. Dan, one of the other guys that we kind of left out in that segment a little bit is Brandon Randolph. And I do want to mention that he has been very impressive in workouts as well. And one of the things, I had kind of mentioned this after watching a few Devereaux games, but like it's one or two Devereaux games. You don't really get a good feel. And he's playing with Samaje, so he doesn't have the ball in his hands all the time. But I felt that like he doesn't force much. He doesn't try to fit it into gaps that he can't. He doesn't charge over people the way a young Mark Lyons did consistently. And he's been compared to Mark Lyons at times. He hasn't quite shown that explosion yet, at least not when I've seen him and not in the summer league. But he has shown a better ability to shoot the ball than Mark did early in his career. And he's also shown a more maturity with the ball in his hands when it comes to decision-making. He doesn't force a lot of things. He doesn't turn it over. He's been very patient and mature in a lot of ways with his game. And I think that's not only opened up my eyes, but it sounds like from what I've been told that it's been that way in workouts too and in open gym. So I think he's a guy that's going to compete for minutes this year as well.
Well, and the first thing that you notice about Randolph, and we saw him at that first game he played in the summer league, is that this is not a guy who's coming into college basketball that really needs a lot of work on his physique and his strength. Right. He is a solidly built 6'1". In fact, he almost looks like, in terms of his body type, he reminds me of a slightly bigger 2 Holloway. Now, 2 is a freshman, not obviously 2 as a junior and senior when he was, you know, looked like he was going to the UFC Pentagon after some of the games, exactly. But or Octagon or whatever they call it.
Exactly.
I don't watch much.
The UFC Pentagon for sure.
Pentagon, Octagon, whatever. Maybe they go to the Pentagon. I don't know. Maybe they could have a UFC thing at the Pentagon.
That's where I was going with that. Yeah.
But I mean, this is not a guy like D. Davis. I think you could make the argument that when he came in, he just wasn't physically mature enough to compete at the level that X needed him. And I think even now there are questions about whether or not he physically can handle playing 35 minutes a night with the abuse that a lead guard is going to take.
Well,
Edmund Sumner's
guys who are going to be the same way.
Right. Miles Davis, another guy who's just – and Miles' problem has been that he needed to keep the weight off.
Right.
And by all accounts, he's in great shape this year. So it looks like the guys have really done a nice job in the weight room, getting themselves in shape, being ready to go. Rick, let's talk about some of the newcomers next year. There's been a lot of talk about Alexander Vezenkov. We know that Chris Mack flew to the Republic of Latvia in the Baltic states, I believe it was last weekend, to take in a few games in the FIBA European Championships, the under-18 FIBA European Championships. Vezenkov, playing for his adopted homeland of Bulgaria, is actually from Cyprus, but I guess his family is from Bulgaria originally. He's been pretty impressive. His team has been awful. They've gotten absolutely destroyed in all 4 of their games. But Vezenkov has done a pretty nice job. He's been playing basically 40 minutes a game. He scored over 20 points in 3 of the 4 games. He shot an excellent percentage. I think he's at close to 60% on 2-point goals. 3-point shooting, not quite there, but solid at the foul line. And getting a good number of rebounds as well. So he has been pretty impressive for a team that's been completely overmatched. I don't know if you've – I guess the question that people are still asking, and it's one that we don't have an answer to, is, you know, is this guy going to be at Xavier in August? And it seems like the staff still – it's still status quo as far as they're concerned. They wouldn't have sent Chris Mack all the way to Latvia if they thought this guy was going to back out of his letter of intent. But on the other hand, as Brian Snow has told us a few times, if somebody comes in with a big professional offer for him – you know, that makes the decision a little bit harder. So this is sort of a touch-and-go thing, and I certainly – you know, somebody made the good point on the message board yesterday that you can believe exactly what the staff says, but until he gets off a plane at Cincinnati Northern Kentucky Airport, there'll always be a little bit of doubt just because there's money at the end of this if he wants it. So it seems like that's the situation with Alexander Vezenkov. Like I said, you know, great playing well on a bad team over in Latvia. And I think they dropped in the loser's bracket now. So maybe we'll see him against – we'll see them play some competition that's more on their level and see what his numbers look like. But he's done real well for playing against some teams that are pretty good, Spain, Greece, Italy, putting up pretty respectable numbers even though his team's been getting hammered.
Yeah, and you're exactly right, Dan. I mean, I can't make a guarantee. I mean, everyone wants a guarantee, I guess, is what they're waiting on me to say, a guarantee one way or the other. And I can't give you one other than the staff fully expects him to be here. He's given them his word. But like you said, there's at the end of the day, if someone wants to give him a ridiculous offer to stay over there and play professionally, then I guess his mind could change. I'm not going to rule that out. I wouldn't rule it out if it was my decision. I could be decidedly going to Xavier. But if someone offers me a whole lot of money to play professionally right away, I might change my mind. I mean, that's just the way it is, especially with a young kid. So, yeah, I mean, other than that, nothing's changed. The staff fully expects him to be at the Cintas Center this fall winter.
Moving to the 2014 class, we'll just update a little bit. Obviously, Rick, you had the Musketeer report on, up on the site last week, which gave a pretty good summary of where things stand. As of right now, the Musketeers' two verbal commitments, Swift and Edmund Sumner. We've talked about Melvin Swift's situation. I don't think we need to get back into it this time. Well, we've talked about both those guys at great length the last few episodes. I don't think we need to get back into it. But the consensus seems to be that Xavier is recruiting two and maybe three spots at this point, under the assumption that Samaje is going to go pro after this season and then, you know, a couple other spots are likely to open up. So, Rick, first of all, let's start with the wings, because this has been sort of what's been perhaps the most current with the emergence of J.P. McCura and Justin Bibbs and then also Gabe DeVoe. Any feel on where things stand with those three guys at this point? Oh, and Trayvon Blewett now, I guess.
Of course, the biggest news in that Musketeer report was that they are back in on Trayvon Blewett. And, you know, I don't want to get people too excited about this. This is a guy who's getting heavy interest from Indiana. They were at every one of his games this past week. They're just hawking him. Purdue's doing the same. Notre Dame's doing the same. Michigan's all over him. Cincinnati is all over him. I mean, it's a lot of big-time teams. Now, Xavier is very much in the mix, and Travis Steele always had a good relationship with the kid, good relationship with his father, and I think he was probably going to end up at Butler. And we've heard the same thing about J.P. McCura, too, so it's interesting how that may have played out, when they may have committed, but he liked Brad Stevens a lot, and his father liked Brad Stevens a lot. And him going to Boston, I think, just kind of shook up his whole recruitment, and what Xavier had been out for a while, but for some reason they are back in heavy consideration, and I think the staff feels like they have a legitimate shot at him, and they've been recruiting him hard here the last 2 weeks. They've been at all of his games. He's played really well. You're talking about a top 45 kid that could add with Edmund Sumner to give Xavier a very impressive backcourt for the 2014 class. Now, again, it's a long shot, but if they were able to haul in a Trayvon Blewett, that would be a big-time get for this staff in the 2014 class. If not Trayvon Blewett, now keep in mind that they would love to take two of these guys. Like, I mean, if they could get J.P. McCura and Trayvon Blewett, they would do that. And same thing with Justin Bibbs and Trayvon Blewett, they would do that. I just don't know that you would get two of those guys to commit to you. After one commits, I think I'd probably rule you out on the others. With J.P. McCura and Justin Bibbs, things are pretty much status quo. I think both of those guys could decide by August, maybe September. And with Blewett, I think you're looking a little bit later, maybe September or farther into the school year a little bit. And then the other thing, you know, is that they're recruiting fours and fives still. I know the Melvin Swift thing is up in the air. We've talked about that. You know where I stand on it. Nothing has changed. There's no official word on that. But they are recruiting fours and fives still. The fours that they're recruiting right now, the two main guys are Keelan Martin and Justin Tillman. And then at the five, it is Chinanu Onowaku from DC Assault, a Maryland kid, and Sean O'Mara from Illinois. And the interesting thing about the 4-5 combo that they're kind of recruiting here is it really could matter who they land first. It doesn't matter which position, but for instance, say they land Keelan Martin. If they land Keelan Martin at the 4, then they'd probably be much more likely to go try to land Chinanu Onowaku at the 5, because Keelan is an offensive weapon, a really skilled kid, but he's only 6'6". He's going to have to defend fours because he's not very quick. He's not a rim protector. He's not a great rebounder. So you're going to lose a little bit of that. So that's probably why you'd go with Onowaku, who's a great rim protector and a big-time rebounder. Then with O'Mara, it's the opposite. He's a very skilled center, not a great out-of-area rebounder, and not a rim protector, not a great athlete, but he's a big space-eating, skilled center, more in like the Stainbrook mold, although maybe not quite that talented, at least not yet. And if you got him, you would probably pair him with a Justin Tillman at the four. More athletic, even though he's only 6'7", 6'8", he's got long arms, a 7'2 wingspan. He can play above the rim and protect the rim. He's a good shot blocker with good instincts and a great rebounder. So, he, you know, again, we've compared him to Travis Taylor in the past. You know how much I hate comparisons, so to say that can tell you how much he reminds me of Travis Taylor. But actually, I think he's a little bit more talented and even a little more explosive than Taylor was.
So that basically lays it out for you. I mean, it certainly is an interesting summer for the Musketeers. We've talked for a long time about how important this 2014 class is for the Muskies, as, you know, going back to what we mentioned at the top of the show, as a transitional class as Xavier steps up from the Atlantic 10 level to the Big East level. Rick, I know that I guess I would just have to refer people to the Musketeer Report for some more information about some other 2014 guys the Musketeers have been linked with, including Bryant McIntosh, the combo guard from Indiana, and some others.
Bryant McIntosh is a guy we should mention, though, because he is a guy they're definitely hard after and they've really liked for a while. Travis Steele has had a great relationship with the kid. He committed early to Indiana State, and I don't know if – I think his dad really pushed him, was a little concerned that he might lose that offer if he didn't commit quickly, and was a little bit concerned about his actual ceiling. But the kid has just continued to impress, and, I mean, he has some big-time interest now. I mean, Butler's all over him. A lot of these schools in the Midwest area are coming after him, and a lot of even the big-time programs, including Illinois and Michigan's and schools like that, are now recruiting him pretty heavily. I know he has a Florida State offer, so he's definitely a guy to keep an eye out on. I know Travis Steele and Coach Mack are going to recruit him hard. He's a combo guard, great feel, great shooter from the outside. Not a tremendous athlete, but is kind of sneaky in the way he's able to get his shots off and can play off the dribble. So definitely a player, think like a Beeline type player. I mean, he would fit in at Michigan really well just because he's a smart offensive player and very skilled. And I think that's why Xavier likes him. He can do a lot of things, play off ball screens, shoot it, just a highly skilled player.
Well, while we're on the subject of recruiting, Rick, I hope you heard Charlie Weiss's what Charlie Weiss had to say today about his new recruiting pitch at Kansas, which was basically telling prospective players at Kansas, have you seen the pile of garbage we have on the team right now? That is not the attitude that Xavier's coaching staff is out there recruiting with, but it definitely shows the lengths to which coaches may go to try and secure some players, especially when the team is in the toilet the way Kansas football is right now, or has always been, really.
That is gold. Absolutely.
They never should have gotten rid of Mangino.
That's right. All right, Dan, that's right. It's time to bring in another big-time guest to the podcast. I'd say, I don't know if he's quite at Andy Mack level, but let's just put it this way. We're going to Indianapolis to get someone a whole lot better than Brian Snow. So, right.
That's right. Our guest tonight is former Xavier player Joe Hughes. Those that I'm sure all current fans remember Joe. He was on the team from 2007 to 2011. Was part of 107 wins as a Xavier player, which is second on the all time list behind Jason Love. And Rick, we got that wrong at the last podcast because we had it backwards. So I just want to make sure I corrected the record. That, you know, we're nothing if not sticklers for complete accuracy on the show when we're not making stuff completely up.
People go to Shannon Russell for hard hitting news anyway, Dan. They just come to us for this. This is what we do.
So Joe, let's I guess the first topic we want to hit with you is obviously the kind of an unpleasant one, but as most fans I think know, at the beginning of this year, you were diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma, cancer of the lymph nodes, and have been undergoing treatment since. And I was kind of hoping that we could start by having you just sort of give the folks out there that may have heard about your diagnosis and your recovery a little status update of how you're doing, how you're feeling, and where you are at this point.
Yeah, that sounds great. I just want to thank you guys for having me on. I've been getting treatment, chemo treatments in Cincinnati. I'm currently living in Indianapolis with my parents. My mom's a retired nurse, and so she's been taking really good care of me. But she'll drive me back to Cincinnati every other Wednesday to receive chemo. And I get that done at the Jewish hospital. Dr. Essel's my oncologist up there, and he's been great. And I've done 11 of 12 treatments so far. And my 12th and final treatment is on July 31st, or at least I hope it's my final one. I'll knock that treatment out on the 31st, and then I get a PET scan 2 weeks after that just to see if all the cancer is gone. Now, I've already gotten one PET scan done about a month and a half ago, and most of the cancer was gone. We're expecting good things from that this next scan. I guess the only somewhat negative thing right now is my platelets have been really low. And platelets basically help clot the blood. So when it gets really low, it can be dangerous. Because I guess worst case scenario, you could bleed to death. But I'm going to have to keep getting medicine after I'm done with the chemo treatments. Sometimes that I've gotten a little bit of medicine for that, and it's not the most pleasant thing ever. So hopefully that doesn't last too long. I'm really excited to just have one treatment left. The support has been pretty amazing. It's going, I think, as well as it can go right now.
Yeah, and that was actually what we wanted to ask you sort of about that. You talked about the support you've received from teammates and coaches and so forth through social media. Has there been anything in particular, anybody that reached out that's been particularly special to you over the last 6 months or so?
Yeah, I mean, there's a pretty long list of things that have just been it's been unbelievable. It's kind of been a roller coaster ride just to find out and January that I had cancer. That was a pretty low time. And then just all of the support that I received after that. I guess one of the coolest people to reach out was Chuck Pagano, the Colts head coach. He sent me an autographed hat, and he wrote a pretty long message or a pretty long letter to me, handwritten letter. I can read part of that if you want, but it was basically said, I want you to know that we will keep you in our thoughts and prayers as you battle lymphoma and deal with your circumstances. Keep a positive attitude and know that you're stronger than you think. His handwriting's a little suspect, but it's a great message. let's see here. It says, this is just a setback for a comeback. Ask God to heal you many times over before you fall asleep and when you awake each day. He makes no mistakes. Believe. I read that all the time, and I just thought that was the coolest thing ever that, he would take the time to do that. So that was awesome. Some of my friends were selling Joe Strong shirts. They're just, T-shirts that they had made, and we're selling those to show support, and I thought that was pretty cool. I played 2 years for Coach Miller. He's not Arizona. And my junior and senior years, I played under Coach Mack. Both of those guys, reached out to me in different ways. Coach Miller left me a pretty long voicemail, fairly recently, just inviting me out to Arizona to golf and go to a game. That's pretty awesome. And then Coach Mack and I, emailed back and forth, and he was just saying that they've been praying for me and want me to come to some Xavier games this year, which I'm really excited about, especially a little more than normal because we're going to be in the Big East, and I think that's pretty awesome.
Well, Joe, let's start right there. I mean, as someone who, like Dan said, you were a part of a whole lot of wins and a lot of bright moments for this team. What does it mean as a former player to see this program move into the Big East and know that you had a part of it and sort of how far, just seeing how far that this program has come in such a short time?
I think it's awesome. You know, nothing against the A-10. The A-10 was a strong conference, but the Big East is, or it's the new Big East is definitely a step up. You know, sometimes in our old conference, there might be a game here and there where you didn't have to maybe prepare as much.
All right, we know what we're talking about. It's Fordham, Joe. It's Fordham. We know.
Yeah, so there are a few teams that, you know, I knew I was going to get some playing time in.
That's right.
I had to really prepare mentally for those games. But,
well, hold on. Well, while we're talking about that, we have to bring up the 2009 game? Because that was one, I think X won like 109-60, but that was the game where you came in with like 90 seconds left and went like Sleepy Floyd on, or like turned into Bernard King for 80 seconds. So that was a pretty crazy one.
Joe, take us through that. Are you just in the zone in that game, or what happened there?
You know, I don't know what it was. Like, if I don't know what got into me, but I remember that was like my personal highlight or best game at Xavier. I had 7 points, and I should have had 9, but I went 2 of 4 from the line. But that was pretty cool. Cool experience to be able to play in a D1 game and, you know, play with the great players that I got to play with.
Joe, one of those great players, I just had, this is completely random. It has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but I just have to get to this before we go any farther with this interview. Can you summarize your time spent with one Jordan Crawford in maybe just a few sentences as best as you can?
JC, well, I roomed with him. Let's see, that would have been my junior year. So I was with him, Andrew Taylor, and let's see, who's the other guy? We had a couple different roommates, Two Holloway, Mark Lyons. So I roomed with a bunch of different guys, but Crawford was always really nice to me. I remember he went out and went to some, I think it was a LeBron James camp, and didn't he dunk on LeBron?
Yeah, he dunked on LeBron, and Nike stole LeBron, the video.
Yeah, something crazy like that. Well, LeBron signed a picture for him, and I remember Crawford was getting ready to leave to start working out for NBA teams, and he was just giving away a bunch of his stuff. And he asked me, he's like, "Do you want this LeBron James autograph?" And I was like, "Hell yeah, I do." I've got that up in my room. But no, Crawford was always really nice guy to me. And I'll put stuff on Facebook now just about my treatments, and JC will like it or something like that. But I still talk with a lot of my former teammates, bunch of the guys. I'd say most of them, contacted me in some way within the past 6 months, just showing support. I thought that was really nice.
Yeah, I mean, Crawford didn't need the picture of LeBron James at that point after posterizing him. So Joe, one of the things you mentioned when you were sort of talking about the folks that reached out to you was the fact that your 4-year career at X sort of straddled the Sean Miller era and the Chris Mack era. And I was wondering if you could give some insight into the differences between Coach Miller and Coach Mack as far as their style and the way they coach the team, and maybe talk a little bit about the differences or the changes that you saw in Chris Mack as he transitioned from being, you know, the number one assistant to being the head coach.
Yeah. I started off, I really liked playing for both coaches. It was pretty cool. I got to, even the assistants, Coach Whitford's now head coach at Ball State, Kelsey's head coach at Winthrop. So I got to interact with a bunch of big time coaches. Coach Miller was, gave me the chance to play at Xavier, and he was a really intense guy. and you know, Coach Mack, when Coach Miller left for Arizona, there was an extra scholarship available, and he gave me you know, a scholarship for a year, and so you know, I definitely appreciated that. But I'd say Coach Miller was a little more intense in practice, but Coach Mack could definitely get after guys too. Coaching philosophy. I mean, we ran some similar offenses. I'd say the defense didn't really change. Offense, we tweaked it a little bit after Coach Miller left, but then they went back to some of the same things. So I don't know if there's really any huge difference in coaching philosophies. They both run the pack line defense. You know, keep it tight, pressure the ball. I really enjoyed playing for both coaches.
Hey, Joe, getting into a little bit of the X and O talk that you're breaking down there for us, fans always enjoy that type of stuff. One of the things that's been interesting to me since Coach Mack has taken over is he's had such a different roster from year to year. I mean, you go from having JC for 1 year where he's your go-to player to then making an offense revolve around two ball-dominant players in Mark and two. And he's gone from, you know, that baseline runner with JC to going to the ball screen motion. Can you just kind of sort of explain the ball screen motion offense a little bit and sort of the advantages it gave to guards like two and Mark? Because a lot of times people see that offense and they don't get it. They see it as just sort of street ball or one-on-one. Can you just sort of explain the advantages of it a little bit?
Yeah, well, I think under you know, Coach Miller, my first couple of years, he ran what's called passing game.
Yep.
We had a bunch of like special plays that we would run, but passing game was the thing we'd run, where it's basically you're just constantly passing the ball, setting screens and cutting. So you're just, you know, it's a motion. You're always moving, trying to get your teammates open. And I really loved the passing game just because it was, you know, the defense kind of knew about it, but it was just tough to guard, and you can only prepare so much for that. The ball screen offense that we switched to, you know, we had some guards. I guess that would have been my junior year with Cheeks, Mark Lyons, and Tutu that could really handle the ball. So we'd have two guards on the wings, on each wing, and then the big men would sprint up from the block and set the ball screen on the wing. Just trying to get those guys to come off the screen and make plays. So it's a little bit different. You know, I wouldn't say we kind of went from more of a passing and moving to more of trying to get playmakers in positions to make plays.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, I mean, they've been doing a little bit of both with Samaje, you know, since they've gotten him, trying to put him in best position. Last year they started off with a little bit of passing game and some motion stuff, and then they ended up going back to some ball screen stuff to try to let him make plays out of the ball screen. I think they'll play a lot like that going forward, too, as they continue to get more guard talent with guys like Miles Davis and Brandon Randolph and even Edmund Sumner in 2014.
So, Joe, you had you were a pretty good high school player at Cathedral Prep in Indianapolis, which at the time I think was one of the top schools in the state. And how was it that you ended up coming to Xavier? I mean, can you talk a little bit about that process? I mean, we talk a lot on this show about how you know, the recruitment of a guy like Samaje Christen might go, but how did that play out for you?
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of an average high school player. I didn't do anything great. I was, you know, about 6'6" and just played hard and was, you know, got good grades. But I guess the main thing that, the main reason I ended up going to Xavier was, Xavier was recruiting Matt Howard, and they may have been recruiting Juwan Johnson also. And I played with, those guys, in AAU. And, you know, Matt Howard went to Butler and Juwan went to Purdue. So, you know, Coach Miller and Coach Mack were at a bunch of our games in the summer. And just, you know, they needed a walk-on and saw that I worked hard. I remember getting a call from Mario Mercurio, who's the director of basketball administration now. And, you know, Mario's got an important job. He schedules a bunch of the games and does a bunch of behind-the-scenes stuff for the Xavier program. But
he's a friend of the podcast.
He's been a guest a couple of times.
Mario's one of the funniest guys I know. He's a good guy. I remember he gave me a call and was just telling me I could, be a preferred walk-on and wouldn't have to try out and, would get to practice with the team. And he's like, you probably won't play much, but you'll be a part of the team and you will get the sickest gear in the nation.
That's Mario to a T.
That sold me. He sold me on the gear.
Well, and really, that's one of, let's face it, that's one of the big perks, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So, we got some pretty cool Nike gear, and I was getting recruited by some smaller D1 schools, but I broke my ankle as a junior in high school. So a lot of those schools, I guess the biggest one was Belmont, down in Tennessee and a couple other schools, but it really ended up being, did I want to play Division II at a smaller school, or get to go to a bigger school and experience NCAA tournament? And my parents said the money thing wasn't an issue, and so that made it a pretty easy decision that I wanted to go play at Xavier.
And you got a whole lot of experience in that NCAA tournament. You saw plenty of that while you were there, so it worked out for the best, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, my freshman year, the Elite Eight, and then sophomore and junior year, two Sweet 16s, and then senior year, we lost in the, I guess they call it second round now, but it's kind of dumb. We lost in the first round. I was a part of some pretty awesome games. Just starting from my freshman year, we played in Puerto Rico, and that was when we beat Virginia Tech.
Was that the Dante?
Jason Love inbounded it over the guy's head. Dante took a couple dribbles, threw up a half-court shot, and drilled it. And I just remember our whole bench stormed the court and, made a dog pile on Dante. So that was an unbelievable game. And we beat Memphis, and Coach Cal was coaching them at the time. They had a really good team. So that was cool. Freshman year, we beat Purdue and Georgia. I remember against Georgia, we were down double digits at halftime. I think that was in the first round, and Coach Miller just got into our three seniors' faces and was just really just chewing them out, like, do you guys want to go out this way? And, that was Josh, Stanley, and Drew. And we came out just fired up in the second half and ended up winning fairly easily against Georgia, then beat Purdue. And then I believe West Virginia was the next game, and that was – maybe one of the most memorable games of my time at Xavier. Just when, never forget BJ hitting that three ball in the wing, and then turning around, his mouth is just wide open, screaming.
I don't think anyone forgets that.
And then the next game in the Elite Eight was against UCLA, and that team was just absolutely stacked. Kevin Love was a big man. They had
Westbrook.
Mapa Amute, who was a big center that would hedge out to half court. And, he was one of the scariest looking guys I've ever seen.
Russell Westbrook, right?
Westbrook. I think Collison. They had, all their starters in the NBA.
Wait, was,
now.
Was J. Rue Holiday on that team, too? They might have had six guys that played in the NBA. I don't think people realize how good that team was. It's amazing. It's amazing that they lost to Memphis in the Final Four that year, because that team should have easily – that team, in my view, was easily the best team in college basketball that year. But
I'm trying to think what we played my sophomore year in the tournament. I remember we lost to Pitt, and Derrick Brown, it was right at the end of the game. I remember he stepped on the line. And I remember kept his foot like, you know, an inch closer to, inside the line. You know, they wouldn't have called him out, and we would probably have won that game. But I think LaVance Field is his name. Hit the big three against us, top of the key.
Knuckleball. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I knew Coach Miller was, really wanted to beat them. You know, he obviously went to Pitt, played there during his college career. Let's see here. Junior year, having a brain freeze.
That was Kansas State.
Kansas State was in the Sweet 16, and Crawford and two both really stepped up in big ways in overtime. And I remember two hit. He had to shoot three free throws with the game on the line, and I just remember thinking, like, man, if I was out there, I would probably pee my pants and airball all of these.
what about the Crosstown Shootout that year? And two made, 11 of 12 free throws or something in regulation and overtime?
Yeah, two was great at driving, getting to the lane, drawing contact. And they did this thing where he would, flip his head back, yeah. And it just looked like the opposing guy, killed him. he was great at drawing the whistle. Crawford just had an unbelievable game against Kansas State, and unfortunately we didn't win that, but that was a great game. It's kind of scary to think how good we could have been that year if Derrick Brown had stayed another year in college. I try not to think about that too much.
Yeah, there's about 10,000 fans who feel the same way.
Yeah.
Why, Joe, you mentioned the going back to talking about Coach Miller, when he decided to leave for Arizona after your sophomore year, that's something that as a fan or as somebody watching the team, obviously it's a big dramatic moment and there's a lot of anxiety, but it's got to be 10 times worse for the guys on the team because in so many ways, your relationship with the school begins with your relationship with the head coach. Can you give some insight into what it was like during those few days where it was sort of a will he or won't he go and the sort of U-turn that he made and how you and the other guys on the team felt through that process by which Coach Mack got the job?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember him telling we were in the locker room and he told us, brought the team in and just telling us we're going to hear a lot about, him going to Arizona and, just don't believe anything you hear. I'm staying here. We knew he had gone out once, to visit Arizona. So I was visiting my girlfriend. She's now my fiance. She went to Miami, Ohio. I just remember people asking me, Coach Miller, heard he's leaving. And I was like, no, he told us he's staying, don't believe that. And then I had heard that he went back out a second time and, they just offered him, the offer was just too much to pass up. And, I can't really blame him. That's just, the amount of money they paid him was unbelievable. I want to say it was 6 years, $17 million or something like that. But it was, a lot more than what he was making at Xavier, and to say I wish he would have stayed because I love Coach Miller, but I can't be mad at him just because of what he was offered. It's it was just too good to pass that up.
Joe, what's been your take? I guess as you look at the program over the last couple of years, obviously there's been a lot of with the Crosstown Shootout fight and some of the subsequent issues that the team had 2 years ago, then last year with being a little bit of a down year. What was your take as you watched the team, especially after that Crosstown Shootout brawl and some of the things that went on? What was your take as that season went on? What did you see from those guys? Because a lot of them were your former teammates that was keeping them from that caused that season to sort of veer off the tracks for a little while before they got things back going at the end?
Yeah. I guess the the biggest thing from the Crosstown Shootout was that the things that were said in the media right afterwards by Two and Cheeks, and they knew that they shouldn't have said that. They were just hyped up and probably should never have been in that position in the first place. But I guess the saddest thing was Two was having an unbelievable season before the Crosstown Shootout. I think they played down at Vanderbilt before that, and I remember Dickie V saying that Two was having like a national player of the year kind of season so far, and then kind of fell off after that. And I think the just some of the negative feedback from Two's comments kind of hurt him mentally, which was sad because I wish Two and Cheeks never would have said that, because Two's such a nice guy, and I've had Two come over to my house in Indianapolis before, and he would talk to my mom and my grandma, and was just nicest kid ever. So it was just sad to see people they just don't know him or know much about him, but all they see him say is gangsta and stuff like that. It definitely hurt him mentally the rest of the year, I think. I don't know if he would ever say that or not, but
Joe, can you kind of lay this out for us a little bit? Because I don't, a lot of people see Two and they see the swagger, they saw the confidence late in games, they saw kind of those eyes where you just knew he was in takeover mode, and he was a tough kid, but he's a different cat. He wasn't, he wasn't like a lot of other guys. Could you sort of describe the way he was? And to me, it seemed like he internalized a lot of the things that were said about him in the media as well, and that really did affect him, and that he was conscious, and it bothered him that people thought that way of him.
Yeah, I mean, I never really talked to him about it, so I don't know, for sure how he felt, but just from seeing his play, you could tell that it affected him in some manner. But I just, wish he hadn't said anything, because it, definitely affected his play. And, I always was a big Two fan, and he's always nice to me and my family. And, I'm glad he's doing well now. A bunch of those guys have hopes to make it to the NBA someday. And, it's so difficult to get there, but, they can make a lot of money in Europe if they, keep working hard. So hopefully, those guys have long careers and maybe have a chance to play in the NBA someday.
Joe, I guess it was your junior year was the year that that Redford was out for the season with his knee injury, and he started doing those videos online with you and Johnny Mazza and Kevin Feeney. Can you talk a little bit about the sort of hijinks that you guys got up to during that season?
Yeah, I'm trying to think what videos we even made. I remember that
Redford's Rundown was the you did the one where you guys were talking about, you kept huddling up and giving him answers, and you discussed your nicknames and.
Yeah, Brad is a character, and we had a great time filming the Redford's Rundown, and he just wasn't sure what he wanted to do after college, whether it was play in Europe or coach or do something with the media. So he's always had an interest in, with media and, making videos and stuff like that. We had a lot of fun doing that. Brad right now is currently working kids out, and, he's just had so many health issues. I think he wished he could have played in Europe, but his body just didn't hold up. But I wouldn't be surprised if, down the road sometime, he's sitting on the sideline somewhere, coaching college basketball.
Joe, I've talked about it before on the podcast, but you got to see it every day. You got to see some of the shooting exhibitions that that guy put on, just in practice or open gyms. How freakish was his ability to shoot the ball at times?
It's unbelievable. You guys may not believe me, but I would go rebound for him sometimes, and it was the easiest job in the world. You just stand under the net with your hand out and just like hit it back to him. You never have to take steps anywhere. But I think he made 56 in a row when I was rebounding for him. But he claims that he's made 90 something in a row, college 3-pointers in a row. And I believe him because it's just, you know, his shot's so pure, and I've seen him make a ton in a row before.
Yeah, I watched him hit 32 in a row on cue for Jeff Goodman after running after practice. So I don't doubt anything he says.
Yeah, he definitely puts in the work. After practice, he would go and get shots up. I would say there were, in my time at Xavier, 3 guys that really stood out in different ways with the hard work that they put in. Brad was just got a ton of reps shooting, just working on his form. Two Holloway just would go in, especially in the summer, was two's big time to get better. But he would get up a bunch of shots on the gun, which is a machine that rebounds the ball and shoots it back out to you. But two was, in the summer, just worked extremely hard. And then Jason Love was a guy that came into Xavier kind of, I don't know if he's fat, but he's chubby for sure. And just worked on his body and, became a beast by the time he was done at Xavier. So those guys, it's pretty cool to see how hard they work.
While we're on the subject of Brad Redford sort of still, I do have to ask you, Joe, this came up. We do a live chat on the website from time to time, and basically fans can come in and just ask questions or whatever. And someone asked the question, and you being a former walk-on, you're familiar with the admiration of the fans, at the end of games, getting the cheers from the fans and everyone yelling shoot. No one knew that better than Brad Redford. I mean, maybe more than any player in Xavier history, he was adored by the fans. Who takes his place? Do you have any opinions on that? Who is the next guy to get the most love from the Xavier fan base?
I don't know. Samaje is, he's going to be the man. I'd say the most skilled player. I think fans like Stanger just because he goes out there and may not be the most skilled player ever, but just works his butt off and dives and, just fun to watch. I would say maybe one of those two, but I really don't know.
I've got my money on Stainbrook. I'm going Stainbrook. The wild hair, the goofiness, the goggles. I'm going with Stainbrook. Dan, who do you got in this race?
I actually think that depending on it, if he gets off to a hot start, I could see Miles Davis.
I could
getting
too,
some of that
he has the
love.
Redford like shooting
because,
ability.
Yeah, just because he's completely bombs away and has no conscience about shooting out to 25 feet.
But let's be honest, Redford, it's really tough to live up to the Redford rep with the fan base because he looked like he could have been any of the fans' sons. Like he looked like he was from Moeller out of the GCL. That's why everyone liked him so much around here. Let's be honest.
Well, not you, because you never miss an opportunity to deride my alma mater. You
yeah,
and Snow.
But I do like B-Red. He's a good guy.
Well, Joe, last couple of questions we wanted to ask you were here's one. Rick and I have talked about this quite a bit when we talk about – in the NCAA tournament, you always see these walk-ons at the end of the bench. They're trying to get on TV, And you've always got the guy that's sort of like the get-back guy and the guy that's doing a crazy dance. What was your role when you were at Xavier, and what do you think the Mark Titus talks about it a lot. He got kind of some notoriety from his blog when he was at his last couple of years at Ohio State. How do you sort of view that? I mean, is that a role that you kind of embraced, or do you like seeing those guys clown around at the end of the bench trying to get on Deadspin?
You know, we didn't really plan anything out. It was just pure emotion. You know, I guess the thing that we kind of plan out is we'd always run out, you know, high five guys, you know, every time. But like for, I don't know, we didn't have any like planned celebrations or anything. I just kind of stuck to the Tiger Woods fist pump or, you know, something simple like that. But I guess one time it was against Kansas State, Feeney. I think, it may have been after Crawford hit the deep three. And Feeney wrapped his towel around my neck, and I felt like I was just like a wild animal. Just like he was trying to, you know, just hold me back from running out and almost choked me to death. But that was the wildest celebration we ever had.
Joe Hughes, thanks a lot for coming on the show with us. Really appreciate it. Seems like a good place to leave it. You know, Rick and I wish you the best. And as you close out your treatment, obviously we hope that the tests next month come back negative and you're back in the gym before too long. Hope to see you down at the Cintas Center this winter.
All right. Well, you know, I'm excited to get back and watch some Big East basketball. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Thanks a lot. That's Joe Hughes, everybody. For Dan, I am Rick. This is the 32nd Darnell Williams edition of the Dana Victory Podcast. Thanks for listening, everyone.